Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
People had to work together. You had to work together, even if you didn't like the person.
One abandoned farm town embodies a forgotten piece of America's past. We continue our month of foraging recipes with a piping hot cup of pine needle tea. And fruit trees need some TLC this time of year. Come with me as we shadow two young farmers on their first lesson in pruning. Let's get a news update first. Here's Mark Chilla.
Monsanto is defending itself against allegations that it doctored research on the safety of its herbicide, Roundup. Internal emails seem to suggest that Monsanto researchers wrote parts of studies on glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup. The research was ultimately published by academics in peer-reviewed journals. But in an interview, Monsanto Vice President Scott Partridge said company scientists did not write the papers, they simply shared information, an act that was credited in the papers themselves. The emails came to light as part of a lawsuit brought by people alleging that exposure to Roundup caused their cancer. President Trump's nominee for Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, is a step closer to confirmation after he handed in paperwork to the Senate Ethics Committee and said he would place assets into a blind trust. That is a step that the former Georgia governor refused to do when he took the state office in 2003. After long and mysterious delays, that move could finally clear the way for a confirmation hearing, though no schedule has been set. Trump named Perdue as his pick for Agriculture Secretary one day before the inauguration in January. And it wasn't a tax that lowered soda consumption in Howard County, Maryland. According to an analysis published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine, it was an advertising campaign that led to a 20% decrease in sales of soda between January 2013 and December 2015. It was called the Unsweetened Campaign. In addition to TV ads and messages on social media, the campaign worked with healthcare professionals to improve messaging that pediatricians could use to educate their patients on the risks associated with excessive sugar intake, including obesity and type 2 diabetes. And you can see one of the videos this campaign produced at eartheats.org.
And Twitter, find us at EarthEats for lots more stories about food and farming. Mark, thanks.
Anytime.
Farmers in the United States are quick to point out that their products feed people all over the world. And while this is a diverse country, the people working on farms and elsewhere in agriculture often don't reflect the population. Changing that is becoming a priority in hopes new people will bring fresh ideas to meet some of our food system's greatest challenges. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports.
Take the long-standing practice of planting only corn or soybeans on millions of Midwest acres. It's worked for a long time, but this monoculture habit can also contribute to problems.
A fair bit of our environmental issues with agriculture across the country, not just in Iowa, relate to a lack of diversity on the landscape.
That's Kendall Lamke. He's chair of the agronomy department at Iowa State University. Agronomists understand soil, plants, and farming practices and advise farmers on how to improve what they do. And Lamke says the field needs fresh ideas. More than 95% of all farmers nationwide are white, according to the most recent census of agriculture.
The way to rediversify the landscape is to rediversify the people in agriculture.
So Lamke launched a statewide marketing campaign called I'm an Agronomist to attract students who wouldn't likely come in the door on their own. He wanted more students, but in particular, he wanted students from a wider pool, from cities and suburbs and from minority groups.
When I started doing this a long time ago, there was some people who weren't happy that we were recruiting people that didn't think like them in agriculture. But in the end, that's how all fields move forward, is bringing in people who don't think like we do.
Lamke's approach is working. Prepare for some numbers here because they say a lot. Enrollment in agronomy has more than tripled since Lamke became department chair in 2006. At that point, there was only one agronomy student who identified as other than white. Today, 23 students do. That's almost 7%.
How are you?
Good.
Liz Hata is one of the new faces in agriculture classes. I met her in a study room at the Parks Library on the Iowa State campus.
I'm a global resource systems major with a technical focus in agronomy.
Hada grew up in a Des Moines suburb, daughter of a Japanese-American doctor and a white stay-at-home mom. Her major has an international focus.
I feel like very, very diverse, much more than the rest of the college bag. But I definitely see that there's a little more racial tension in the college bag than I was expecting.
It's something animal science major Melissa Garcia Rodriguez also notices. Her parents are Mexican immigrants, and though she grew up in a city, she's planning to become a large animal veterinarian. Many of her classmates have raised livestock on family farms. She already feels like an outsider, and when she questions the way they want to do something, some just shut her down.
There's that awkward tension, like, oh, okay, then go somewhere else because you don't belong here, you don't do this. Like, they don't say that, but that tension is definitely there.
Whether about animal husbandry or more general chatter over politics, Garcia says she's typically not one to speak up, especially when loud classmates share views different from hers.
I just stay quiet and I keep it civil.
Garcia and Hada are quick to point out that many students and faculty have been supportive. For trailblazers, being the one who is different can be a strain. Some workplaces in the industry are also trying to change. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has worked for years to become more diverse and inclusive. For example, the department increased recruiting at historically black colleges. Since 2011, the number of non-white USDA employees nationwide has increased 5 percentage points to 28% today.
The best, smartest, most innovative people come from all walks of life.
That's Iowa State's Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion, Reginald Chen Stewart. He says these efforts are logical and perhaps even necessary.
You have to cast the net wider, I think, to catch the biggest fish.
Whether those fish ultimately sink or swim will depend not just on their preparation and tenacity, but also on the feel of the water they dive into. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Last week, we had California farmer and author Mas Masumoto on the show to talk about the theory of pruning peach trees. Since we're still right in that pruning time of year, I wanted to get a hands-on lesson from someone a little closer to home. Nightfall Farm is located near Crothersville, Indiana. It's a 250-acre area, some of which is wetlands, some of which is rented out to other farmers. Nate and Liz Brownlee farm 15 acres themselves. This is Liz's family land that they converted from conventional corn and soybean production into pasture for their chickens, turkeys, sheep, and pigs. They grow a small garden, and they have about a dozen fruit trees. This land has a lot of history on it, but much of that history was made before Liz and Nate took the reins. But this little orchard is chapter one of their farming story.
So today we're doing something totally just for fun. We put some apple and pear and other trees into the ground 3 years ago when we moved home, and now it's time to give them some love.
Liz is 30 years old, Nate is 32. The apple, peach, pear, cherry, and nut trees mark the perimeter of the garden. The trees look rough, very scraggly, and in need of a good prune. Liz and Nate know it, but they called Chris Medic for help before they started pruning away. Chris is the Purdue Extension Educator for Bartholomew County, and she just happens to be a board-certified arborist. Despite our unseasonably warm day, she says this is the perfect time of year to prune fruit trees, because you can see the structure of the tree, and you can guide the growth of it for the coming season.
The weather is going to vary, and we'll have cold weather again, and this is a perfect time to prune, February, March, and usually, depending on the species that you're pruning, you might be waiting until later in the year for the stone fruits, because they're more susceptible to winter damage, which we're still eligible for. So, yeah, it's perfect. We just happen to be lucked out on a warm day.
Chris, what can we carry?
All of it.
Yeah, perfect.
Chris has brought an entire shed of tools. She sets up a folding table and lines up all her pruning tools, 4 different types of hand tools for cuts that are pencil-sized and smaller. She's brought several styles of loppers. One has shock absorbers. And then she has a tree saw for cuts that are larger than 4 inches. We start with a young apple tree.
There's kind of a dichotomy of forms that you want to have as a goal when you're pruning fruit trees. And an apple like this will be trained to a central leader. Mm-hmm. And this has a great start. You know, this has a strong central leader. And eventually you will have branches coming out in what we hope will be a scaffold arrangement. So maybe a branch coming out here, and another one on the other side, and another one on the other side, and another one on the other side.
Perfect. Do you have a more mature tree we can go to next?
Yeah, let's jump to this one.
Okay. Liz grew up on this farm, but she didn't grow up farming. By the time she was on the scene, her folks had stopped working the land themselves, and instead they rented it out.
When they got married, they bought this farm, and they did the kind of standard corn, beans, wheat. 20 had a beef cattle, some hay land, and they just couldn't make it work. The policy was get bigger, get out, and they weren't going to get any larger. But they did something special. They held on to the land.
She and Nate met at Hanover College. He came to agriculture by way of his anthropology degree. They traveled after college, working on farms in Pennsylvania, Maine, and Vermont.
At the end of the day, we were working on great farms, but we were giving the best of ourselves to another farmer, and we'd been married for about 3-4 years. I'd come home blown, so I'd be on the floor while she was in school, and we didn't have much quality time as husband and wife. We were moving every year or two, and so we weren't really kind of putting down roots and able to build towards a project or a vision or a goal. And her dad was sick, and land access is one of the biggest hurdles for young beginning farmers. So it seemed like a no-brainer. Come home where family is, where dad needed help, and where we would have a chance to build our own thing, to put the best of ourselves into our own farm.
That was the winter of 2013. For their birthdays and for Christmas, they asked their family and friends to buy them these fruit trees. This is the first year they're likely to get fruit. We walk to another tree that Chris identifies as a cherry tree.
It's got what we call codominant trunks. Codominance is kind of a liability in trees because you've got two trunks that are in competition with each other. Had you trained this tree at the stage where this one is, you would have removed one of those trunks. But at this stage, we'll probably keep it.
We're looking to make a lot of thinning cuts on this one. Chris says to remove any growth that's dead or dying. Remove branches that are crossing or rubbing, broken or diseased, and trim branches that are pointing toward the interior of the tree or branches that are pointing upwards.
You can see this is vertical.
Right, that's a very funky branch.
And you can see that it doesn't have any fruiting buds on it. So this is going to go, right? This has nothing to offer. This is a sucker, as they say, a vertical. Then they can go.
This feels very high stakes. Like, what if they clip something that shouldn't be clipped?
Yeah, I don't think you can go wrong here.
So that's great to hear because I've always been terrified of pruning.
Uh-huh.
So the idea that, you know, I can't make any major mistakes is reassuring. It makes me more likely to do this again next year in a timely manner.
It looks so much better.
Yeah, I agree. It looks more like a fruit tree.
Neat and tidy.
This is actually a pretty logical process.
And the hope is, with regular, logical pruning, they'll encourage the trees to bear more fruit. These trees represent the Brownleys' hope for the future of their farm. They want to continue growing their meat operation, and eventually they see their animals grazing underneath the shade of these trees. They also want to be the primary food source for about 10 family members. Liz's father was initially nervous about their decision to come back home and farm. He died a couple years ago.
He lived long enough to see the pigs on the farm, and you know, he knew we had gone to go pick up the chickens from the butcher, so he knew we had something to sell. And I think, you know, we have a lot of questions we wish we could have asked. He wasn't the most communicative there at the end, so we couldn't ask which are the wettest fields and what has your experience been, because they've been here 42 years at that point.
But they're figuring it out. They're still investing in the farm's infrastructure. So they're not turning a profit just yet. They get influxes of cash from their CSA members and from Thanksgiving turkey sales. But as Nate put it, they're happy to give the best of themselves to their farm.
Now we're passionate about it. Hoosiers have a lot to be proud of. We're not just a crossroads of America. And there's a lot that, you know, we need to do to fight the brain drain. We went to New England to learn how to farm. Vermont was a great place to be farming. The culture was very supportive. We were engaged in a really phenomenal network of mentors and other beginning farmers. But if everybody leaves and stays in Vermont, Vermont gets not that much better, and Indiana gets worse.
Chris makes her way around to all the fruit trees at Nightfall Farm, pruning and teaching as she goes. Liz and Nate collect the brush to give to their goats later. See pictures of our day at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail, more information at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. Okay, so pruning will help your trees bear fruit. It's also a good idea to do your best to protect them from pests. And in Daniel Orr's case, it's deer that really wreak havoc on his fruit trees.
Some apples, pears, plums, and they attacked them one night and just ate all the leaves off those poor little trees. So that's what got me inspired to make this.
He's come up with an anti-pest potion that uses ingredients you probably already have in your kitchen.
And it's really simple. And what you want to do is you want to let it kind of brew for a little while so it kind of really develops a little bit of a stink to it. And you may not want to use this on your plants right by your front door, but the ones that the deers attack out towards the edges of the garden, you might want to use this. Now, what I've got here is just a plain old egg, and I'm going to crack that into a blender. Add some fresh chilies, and you want to use the hotter the better. I'm going to add about a quarter cup of buttermilk. You could use yogurt or plain milk, but the buttermilk seems to kind of go rancid a little bit quicker. And then we're going to add some garlic. And throw that in the blender. And then we'll add about a quarter water to this, and then you can mix another 2 quarts in at the end, so you have about 3 quarts of spray. All right, so we're going to give this a whiz. I'm also going to add, I've got some garlic chives out of the garden. We're going to throw those in there too. So that'll give us some nice stink as well. And you can also, if you want to, add just a little bit of salad oil, about a tablespoon to a gallon. And what that will do is that will help it stay on the tree. It will coat it and make it stick to the tree a little bit better. All right, once that's nicely pureed, we're going to add that to a jug with 2 more quarts of water. Smells a little bit like a green goddess dressing, but believe me, once this sits for a day or two outside at room temperature, it's going to develop a real strong aroma. Believe me, it'll keep the rabbits, the deers, and other little critters away from your tender little lovely garden plants.
There are other techniques for managing pests. Just go to our website and search for pests and let us know what works in your garden. Our email is eartheats@gmail.com. The Great Plains are dotted with abandoned towns, and each one has its own story of settlers moving in and then eventually moving on. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon visited one such town, and it sheds light on a forgotten piece of American history.
Picture this. You're on dry, dusty plains. The grass is crispy and straw-colored, and you can just barely see the snow-capped Rocky Mountains to the west. That's the scene an hour's drive northeast of Denver.
So this is what's left of the great community of Deerfield, Colorado.
I'm here with George June. He's a professor at the University of Northern Colorado and the resident expert on Deerfield. We're next to the town's old lunch counter. Today it sits next to a highway, partially collapsed, its wooden beams warped and cracked from the wind.
And as you can see, there's not that many structures left.
It's been 100 years since Deerfield's streets were bustling with homesteaders, but it's not the town that's interesting. Instead, June says, what makes Deerfield special is the people that lived here.
It was the most successful, best-known African-American farming community in the United States at the time.
Starting in 1910, Deerfield began attracting hundreds of black homesteaders. They came to the town for opportunity, and for a while, it thrived.
It pulled together primarily African Americans who were interested in owning their own homes, their own farms, and that's what pulled them to Deerfield.
The community was the vision of its creator, a man named O.T. Jackson. He was a successful black entrepreneur from Ohio. He started restaurants and worked for a few Colorado governors. Jackson wanted a place where black people could take out loans, work the land, and get ahead. And he saw promise in Deerfield.
So he thought that if given the chance and the opportunities, other African Americans could achieve as well. And so there, this part of it, he wanted people to come out here and to make something of themselves.
June says what's amazing about the town is that it gained a foothold during an incredibly tense time in America. Deerfield, along with other predominantly black towns like Nicodemus, Kansas, and Boley, Oklahoma, sprang up at the height of the Jim Crow era, when segregation was the law of the land. An active Ku Klux Klan chapter started in Denver around the same time. But despite rampant racism and violence in parts of the country, June says the residents of Deerfield mostly found harmony with their neighbors.
People had to work together. You had to work together, even if you didn't like the person. So I think this whole thing about the solitary Westerner and everything like that is a bit overdone because you had to rely on your neighbors.
You could see that on display at the town's dance hall. Deerfield was home to Squire Brockman, a well-known black musician, and he'd set up shop on Saturday nights to play music like this.
And the white people in the area would come out here and they would dance. Now at that time, it was black people and white people couldn't dance as couples at all, but they were on the same dance floor together. And so again, you start to have the roots of some of the integration kinds of things because people respected each other and they needed each other.
For about 20 years, the town was a success until the 1-2 punch of the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl. In the early 1930s, it stopped raining. Deerfield's seasonal creeks dried up, so did its wells. And by 1940, Deerfield was largely deserted. Many people moved to Denver's Five Points neighborhood. Just a few residents hung on.
It was a wonderful idea, wonderful experiment, but the spinoffs were just as important.
Spinoffs, like one of Colorado's first integrated schools just down the road from Deerfield, and the dozens of other black farm communities on the plains that saw Deerfield's success and tried to replicate it. That's Deerfield's legacy, June says. It thrived for years during a period in American history that was fraught with racial tension, building a community at a time when that seemed impossible. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
See the pictures that Luke snapped at harvestpublicmedia.org. Let's go foraging now for pine needles. Shane Gibson is the Environmental Education Director at the Sycamore Land Trust. I joined him on a visit to Templeton Elementary School about a month ago on a cold and blustery day. He was leading a group of about a dozen K through 6th graders, all of whom chose to take part in this lesson.
Take this pan, we'll collect some of our pine needles in this pan, and let's go over here and find a white pine tree.
First thing Shane emphasized was to know without a shadow of a doubt that what you're about to eat is safe. We need to find a white pine tree because with those pine needles, we'll be making tea.
But let's look, if you look at, you find, if you look at it all together, it looks like a big bunch of needles.
Yep.
But if you find a little small cluster where it comes out together, and you peel it apart, kind of, and
I found one.
And count them, you will see that
five.
All right, so I like to kind of give the tree like a haircut. So here's what I do.
Cool.
So I just take like a section like this, and I'll trim it, and then we can just drop it into our containers. So if you'll take a pair of scissors and just trim. So there's the scissors for you. Put them in the, Lydia's got the containers.
I didn't get it here.
This is a lot of pine needles.
Put it into the,
I agree with her.
Thank you.
So here's what we're gonna do. We are gonna have, everybody can do this.
Okay.
We'll just take turns here. So one at a time, you can just take it and kind of cut it up into each different pot, okay? There you go, cut it and drop, cut it over the water.
This is gonna be awesome.
Awesome.
Would
so,
you?
That's all. How do you guys feel about going ahead and trying some that I made this morning?
Yeah, I want some of that
all
now.
Right, I'm gonna pass out the cups.
Well, take that tray and we'll move it over by Jack.
Come on, let's go.
Why don't you just take like one push down on the thermos? And,
whoa, oh, gee, wow!
With your cup underneath it.
Can you push for me?
Just one. Oh, that's gonna be plenty. Cause you want to make sure you like it.
Okay,
that's good.
Did you get some?
Okay. It tastes kind of like water, a little, sweet. But it's like with like a hint of sugar.
I think it sort of tastes like spicy, but like not really spicy. Like
the longer you let it steep, the stronger taste it'll have.
Good.
If you sweetened it up, yeah, it would taste pretty good.
Yeah,
I'm not saying it tastes bad, but
let's just say it tastes like good.
It tastes weird. It tastes like
little. How many cups have you had? Is this like three or four?
Well, I think it's like my third.
So you must really like it. Are you gonna make this at home, do you think?
If I can find a pine needle tree at my house, I would make it.
Wow, we've almost emptied this.
Pine
cheers.
Cheers
to pine needle tea!
Cheers to pine needle tea!
Thanks to Shane Gibson of the Sycamore Land Trust and everyone at Templeton Elementary School. Go to eartheats.org for a refresher on the characteristics of a white pine tree. You'll also find the recipe for Daniel's deer repellent while you're there, and more news stories posted by our bloggers Taylor Killow and Chad Bouchard. We also get stories from Harvest Public Media and Indiana University's Food Institute. John Bailey is our executive producer. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Do me a favor today and show a friend how to subscribe to our podcast. It's free, and it makes listening that much easier. Tell us about it on Twitter with the hashtag TryPod, that's TRYPOD. Okay, thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.